Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our political analysts, Rachel Payne Caulfield is with us, professor of political science at Drake University. Rachel, thank you for joining us. I know your duties, teaching duties at Drake University have prevented us getting together for quite a while. We are sure glad to have you back.
Well, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Joseph Jones. Joseph Jones joins us for the first time. He is executive director at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. That's home. It's housed at Drake University. Joseph, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. And hey, Rachel.
Hi.
And I wanted to make sure, Joseph, because this is your first time here, that our listeners are aware of the goals of your nonpartisan institute here, because we typically have our analysts from universities, as Rachel, from in colleges around the university. This is a nonpartisan institute with the goals of what?
Well, thanks for asking, Ben. So we are a nonpartisan public policy think tank based at Drake University. So I get to engage with Rachel and her students quite a bit. And we focus on policy research concerning people with disabilities, labor and employment, retirement security, and wellness and nutrition. We also try our best to engage the public with how public policy is made and with their elected officials. So really, it's a way for us to continue the legacy of Senator Tom Harkin after his 40 years in Congress and to allow people to do research based on those issues that he found important as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the interest of full disclosure, you are an office holder there in the community in the Des Moines area.
Yes, I'm a city council member in the small hamlet of Windsor Heights.
Okay, we have those preliminaries out of the way. Let's get right to plenty of political news to analyze. Later in the hour, we certainly want to talk about the upheaval, the nationwide protests, the civil unrest, the violence as well, the political aspects of that. We want you to join us with your questions this hour and comments. Listeners, have we come to a crossroads in civil rights? If so, how would you describe this moment? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Before we talk about that, we have quite a bit to talk about because of the primaries yesterday in Iowa and I believe seven other states, as well as the District of Columbia. It's our Iowa news that has the national news in its headlines. The story found its way all the way to the national news outlets because in the 4th District, Republican voters have ousted U.S. Representative Steve King, brings to an end nearly two decades of controversy that he's brought to the most conservative district in the state. Senator Randy Feenstra of Hall won a little over 45% of the vote to King's 36%, a margin just under 8,000 votes, according to the Secretary of State's office. Feenstra defeating Jeremy Taylor, the former Woodbury County supervisor, also a state lawmaker who received just under 8% of the vote. Brett Richards, an Army veteran, was also in that primary. And also a businessman from Irwin, also Steve Reeder, defeated there. Let's listen to the victor in yesterday's primary, State Senator Randy Feenstra, thanking supporters, volunteers, and campaign staff on Facebook Live last night, securing the Republican nomination for Iowa's 4th District. He will face off against Democrat J.D. Scholten, who ran unopposed yesterday in the November general election. Let's listen.
Our campaign was fueled by over 600 county chairs in all 39 counties. It was fueled by 260 students that helped call and write postcards and got involved. We were so excited, and all of a sudden the coronavirus hit, and all of a sudden we had this grassroots helping me out, and I'm so grateful for them. I said from day one that Iowans deserve a proven, effective conservative leader that will deliver results. And I have done that in the Iowa Senate, being in the Iowa legislature for the last 12 years. And I promise you, I will deliver results in Congress.
Okay, let's listen to The loser in that contest, a video posted to Facebook, of nine-term U.S. Representative Steve King spoke briefly from his home after losing the Republican primary race yesterday for the 4th District seat to Randy Feenstra. Let's listen to
But I want to thank all the supporters that we've had over the years, the people that have stood with me through this time. And I would also point out that of all of the four opponents that I've had in this race, not one of them has raised an issue with a single vote I've put up or a single statement that I have made. And that's pretty interesting when you think of nearly 18 years in the United States Congress, and no one's disagreed with the positions that I've taken. Neither do I have any accusers. This comes from an effort to push out the strongest voice for full-spectrum constitutional Christian conservatism that existed in the United States Congress. And what I regret is these tactics may get legs and be used against the next most effective, then the next.
Okay, Rachel, take a stab at this. Give us your reaction there. Perhaps comment on Steve King's remarks there as well, parting remarks.
Well, I have to say, I am not often shocked, but I have always said that I thought this seat belonged to Steve King for as long as he wanted it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Randy Feenstra was very effective in taking it away from him. Somebody, you know, some might claim that Steve King abdicated his place through the comments that he's made over the years and doubling down on many of those comments, as he did again in his concession speech, such as it was. And I think one of the things that's really interesting here, if you look at some of the counties that Feenstra was able to win, and it's not a surprise, of course, that he did particularly well in the northwest corner of the state, Sioux County, 81% of the vote. That's incredible. Obviously, that's his home base. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that is a remarkable win for Feenstra. And he did it on a fairly limited spending. He had, you know, about $1 million, $900,000 that went into this race in a divided field. But every Republican that I speak to regularly, they are equally shocked, and they tend to be very pleased. They see this as a new generation of Republican for that portion of the state.
Right. The GOP chair, Ronald McDaniel, in a tweet, Steve King's white supremacist rhetoric is totally inconsistent with the Republican Party, and I'm glad Iowa Republicans rejected him at the ballot box. Let's go to you, Joseph Jones, for your reaction to, a shocking result in this 4th district primary.
Yeah, and I think it was not only shocking to us, but it was obviously shocking to the entire country. I think the national media picked it up immediately, and we started to see a lot of conversation about what exactly happened in the 4th district. And I agree with Rachel. I first came to Iowa the year that Steve King was elected, and to see an incumbent of his tenure lose so heavily in Sioux County in particular was a big kind of signpost to me. But I think the folks that I know who live in the 4th district are really looking for people who are willing to work on their behalf. And of course, the congressman lost his committee assignments, and you really want somebody who's in the game. You want to be able to have your voice heard in the halls of Congress and amongst the other members of Congress. And I think the people in the 4th district were saying that they were not being represented that way anymore, and they want somebody who is looking to really have the same shared values that they have, but also, I mean, they have some real issues that they want worked on too, like protecting Social Security and some constructive work on drug prices and reforming the healthcare system. So I think that it was shocking, but I'll be interested to see what happens in the next wave and which of those two candidates they decide represents their district the best.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, he will now face J.D. Shulton. Could we say in an indirect way that J.D. Shulton, becoming within, 2 or 3 percentage points of nearly winning in 2018 when he faced King, really has part of this takedown of Representative King?
Well, I think in part of Steve King's appeal was that he was virtually unbeatable in the 4th District, and Shulton demonstrated that that was not the case, and that may have undermined some of that appeal to his core base of voters. Having said that, I think if anyone is really disappointed in the outcome of this particular primary race, it would be J.D. Shulton. This is a heavily Republican district, and I think that Randy Feenstra is likely to perform better than Steve King does in a general election. And so, you know, this race is going to be, as are all Iowa races this cycle, but this race is going to be a particularly interesting one to watch. I do think it's worth noting, because he brought it up in this concession speech, he claims that none of the opponents that he faced in this primary really criticized any of his comments, but that was a strategic decision by Feenstra. It's not that he doesn't disagree with King's comments, it's that in an effort to appeal to a broad base of Republican voters, he really downplayed any personal attacks on King or on his beliefs or on his comments, and really focused, as Joseph said, on the loss of committee assignments and the fact that King was unable to make effective change because he had been sidelined in the congressional structure of decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on from the 4th District. Well, plenty of time to talk about that Shulton-Feenstra matchup in the months to come before the November election. Let's dash through these other primaries that didn't get the national headlines that the 4th District did. As expected, let's move to the 3rd District. As expected, this November, Republican David Young will have the chance to try to reclaim the 3rd District congressional seat that represents Des Moines, also largely covers southwest Iowa. Yesterday, Young defeated retired U.S. Army Colonel Bill Schaefer to win that nomination. He'll face U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, a Democrat, in November. It was Axne who defeated Young by 2.2 percentage points, fewer than 8,000 avoids, if I'm remembering right, Axne won only one of this district's counties in 2018, Polk, but so heavily, obviously, that she won the race. Joseph, give us your reaction to this. Not really a surprise, is it?
No, it's not really a surprise, and it's a rematch. Obviously, that's coming ahead in November between the former congressman and the current congresswoman. And I think that again, voters in the 3rd district where Rachel and I are going to really consider who represents them best and represents their values, and would be able to work constructively on all the things that this next Congress is going to have ahead of them. And it's going to be a heavy lift to go through some of those issues like infrastructure and surveillance reform, and obviously more pandemic response. They're going to have to, have some stimulus there and talk about infectious disease and public health and maybe broadband enhancement. I mean, there's going to be a lot of serious work that's going to happen starting in January. And I think that the district is going to be looking for which one of the two of them is going to be able to have those conversations most constructively and effectively get the job done.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, comment on this. This will be Cindy Axne's first time defending that 3rd district House seat. How do you see the matchup?
Well, the 2018 race, as you noted, really hinged on Polk County. And a lot of effort has gone in among the Democrats in shoring up their voter registration numbers across the 3rd district. And so, in an effort to maintain the seat, I think one of the things that Cindy Axne is going to lean heavily on is this trend toward, first of all, really focusing on suburban communities, but also reaching out to those rural communities that she's been able to create relationships with. So in 2018, if you look at the Secretary of State's website, among active voters, Democrats had about a 16,000 voter vote advantage. So there were about 16,000 more active registered Democrats in the 3rd district than there were active registered Republicans. And that gap has now widened to about 30,000. So that could be a really nice cushion for Cindy Axne. The question is, has she done enough in Congress, and has she maintained the connection to constituents' interests in a way that really allows her to capitalize on those relationships and maintain support. David Young, you know, I think faces a different election in 2020 than he did in 2018, primarily because it is a presidential election year. And so with Donald Trump on the ballot, you get a much broader base of voters who will turn out in November.
In the interest of time, I'll just briefly mention the first district primary outcome. The state representative Ashley Hinson will represent the GOP in its bid to win back that seat, representing Northeast Iowa. Hinson challenging U.S. Representative Abby Finkenauer, Democrat, also her first re-election bid. The second district, if we swing down to the southeast part of the state, the second district currently being held by Democratic Representative Dave Loebsack. He announced last year he would not run again. State Senator Marionette Miller-Meeks of Ottumwa won the Republican nomination yesterday. She will face Democrat Rita Hart in the general election. But I want to get to this primary decision in the Senate race, because Republican Joni Ernst defending that U.S. Senate seat, she also will be defending for the first time Democrat Teresa Greenfield, the one chosen by Iowa Democrats to take on Ernst this November. She defeated Kimberly Graham, Eddie Morrow, and Mike Franken. Comment on this. This is a big one watched nationally, Joseph, also because, of course, the Senate perhaps hangs in the balance if the Democrats have anything to say about it.
Senate certainly does hang in the balance, and I think that the primary race was a prime example of just how much the party nationally is really getting behind trying to take back the Senate. And I think to your larger point about the different races, and you know, we've gone from just a few years ago where we had a pretty tenured delegation representing us in Congress to, at the end of this year, we'll have at least two first-term House members, and could possibly have two first or second-term House members. And you know, everyone is fairly fresh and fresh faces for the state of Iowa. The other thing that's really heartening to me is that you know, we know that Iowa will be represented by a woman in three of these five federal races that are happening, and that's an absolute. For a state that hadn't elected a female to a federal office just a few years ago. So I think that's going to be really important. But I wonder how much of the pandemic situation has affected our campaigning and the ability for those candidates to really connect with their voters. I think that that's going to still play a little bit into as we go forward. But of course, since we have a presidential race at the top of the ticket, that's going to affect turnout as well. I spent the day yesterday as a poll worker, and I was really excited by the number of people who had come out in addition to all the absentee ballots that were there. So it looks like people are hungry to make change and to have their voices heard and to still participate in the democracy and try to get people on the ballots who will represent their values and really push forward their policy issues.
Rachel, before you react to this Senate primary and the matchup we have for that in November, just to tag on to what Joseph mentioned there, we have Iowa setting a new primary election turnout record yesterday, absentee voting surging in the midst of this coronavirus pandemic. According to the Iowa Secretary of State's website, more than 410,000 people voted absentee this year. That's a dramatic upsurge compared to the 38,000 absentee votes cast in the 2016 primary election. But your thoughts?
Right, about 15,000 in 2018, yeah.
Right. So comment on the Senate matchup now that we know Teresa Greenfield is the candidate there.
Well, so this is, and I agree with Joseph wholeheartedly, I find one of the most interesting and exciting things about this particular cycle, the fact that, you know, as of 2014, Iowa had never elected a woman to Congress, and we now have a Senate race, and we have two House races where all of the candidates are women, which I think is really exciting. In the Senate race, one of the things that I was really keeping an eye on last night was how Teresa Greenfield was doing in rural areas of the state. Mm. And she did exceptionally well in those rural areas. She won all but one county, I believe. But you look at some of these, you know, she won Ida County by 70%, Sac by 65, Pottawatomie County, 64%. So you go around the state and you see this, the strong performance by Teresa Greenfield, which I think bodes well because for her, because I think it means that she has really invested in that statewide operational effort that's going to be necessary. And this is why primaries can be so important for candidates. It gives them a chance to define themselves to the electorate, but they also start to build out an organization. They start to find those key activists and supporters in the areas where they're most going to need them in the general election. This is going to be a rough general election, and all eyes are going to be on Iowa. We should expect to see just outrageous sums of outside money spent in this race. So right now we already know that $25 to $30 million has been reserved for this race. It will end up much, much, much higher than that. And just by comparison, in 2014, this Senate seat, the outside spending was about $63 million. So, I mean, this is going to be a... this is going to be a brutal, knockdown, drag out general election fight. I do think that the turnout that we saw in this primary race, particularly absentee voting that we saw in this cycle, I think it tells us something about the level of excitement among voters. They see their involvement in politics as essential. I also think the Secretary of State's push for absentee voting in the wake of the virus was incredibly important. And has really potentially transformed the way voters view their responsibility of voting.
Rachel, we have about a minute before we have to go to break, but just to follow up there, voting by mail, absentee voting has surged, but it's also become controversial. Is there any evidence to support President Trump's claim that voting by mail disadvantages Republicans?
Well, there is some evidence to support that in the sense that the easier it is to vote, the more people participate. And that's particularly true for people who are salaried, who lack regular childcare or transportation to the polls, who are unable to, you know, to get time off to vote on a Tuesday. Voting is not convenient. In-person voting is not always convenient. And for those populations for whom it is least convenient, providing alternatives will make it more likely that they are able to participate. So there is some evidence that Democrats benefit from alternative voting mechanisms. And that is a structural, a structural argument, not an ideological one in my mind.
Okay, we'll be back with Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. Joseph Jones is executive director of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, joining us today with analysis. We hope you'll join us when we talk about the politics of what we've been experiencing nationwide, the demonstrations, the civil unrest, and the violence. We'll talk about it when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
So glad to have you on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, the U.S. has a tradition of ex-presidents and sitting presidents getting along or becoming allies, even across the partisan divide. We've heard in this era differences there on that tradition. Tomorrow, two presidential historians, Tim Walsh and Tim Naftali, discuss relationships between the men who've occupied the Oval Office. Also, our historians tomorrow will give us their thoughts on the current unrest. We invite you to join us tomorrow on River to River. Well, today on our program, it's a Politics Wednesday edition with Joseph Jones, for the first time on our Politics Wednesday, executive director at the nonpartisan Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Rachel Caulfield, an old hand, if I can put it that way, professor of political science at Drake University, has been with us for many years. We're so glad to have them on board this hour. We want to have you share your thoughts, your questions this hour. as we discuss this protest, the civil unrest, does it feel like we've reached a crossroads here? If so, how would you describe that crossroads? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, those demonstrations beginning last week after the Minneapolis police officer was videotaped kneeling on the neck of George Floyd for nearly 9 minutes, even after George Floyd appeared to lose consciousness, the officer charged with murder. Last night, protests in most major cities, relatively calm, many cities intensifying their curfews. Our state capital, there hundreds of Iowans marching peacefully through the downtown area, also the East Village, urging justice for George Floyd and other Black Americans who've been killed by police. In Waterloo, police using tear gas, according to reports there, flashbangs to break up protesters late yesterday evening. Also, hundreds gathering in downtown Iowa City. According to reports there, law enforcement in helmets and other riot gear, keeping an eye on protesters, not, though, engaging them for most of the evening. Nationwide, at least 9,300 people have been arrested in protests around the country, according to a tally by the Associated Press. Let's listen to State Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad joining Governor Reynolds and other officials and community leaders on Monday in our state capitol, addressing protests that happened across Des Moines over the weekend. Akeo Abdul-Samad thanking protesters for coming out with a justice-minded mission, speaking out against what he described, in his words, as the 3% of people who were distracted from the civic engagement message of the protest with acts including property destruction later in the night. Let's listen.
But these individuals who hijacked it, a message has to be sent to them. We are all in this together, and we're not going to let you hijack our babies. We're not letting you hijack our message, and that you need to take that out of Iowa, because Iowans have come together to stand together and make sure that you can't hijack what we have.
Representative Abdul-Samad, they're calling for systemic change, asking leaders to bring young voices to the table to look for these types of solutions. Let me turn to you, Joseph. First of all, as an African-American, not only as the executive director of the Harkin Institute, give us your reaction to the last few days here. What an upheaval. We certainly have that sense once again that we are living some very important history in this country.
Yeah, Ben, I think, you know, watching that the latest video of the killing in Minneapolis was heart-wrenching. Words can't really come into play about how I felt and how I felt about that family. I think my own personal stories are not unique or even rare amongst Black men. And I think the thing that you're seeing now is a community-wide response, a nationwide response amongst people of all races who want to fight back against injustice. And this is something that's been simmering for a while. And so what you're seeing is the result of this long standing set of issues having to do with wage gap and inadequate access to healthcare and food insecurity and housing discrimination. And Akeo's right. You know, you can't lose the message of what the justices were trying to gain based on the small number of people who are creating acts of vandalism and who are really distracting from the main message that's out there. And in full disclosure, I used to work for Akeo, and we've been friends for years. And I, you know, just watched him tirelessly the last several days really try to engage the mostly young crowd of people who are there to voice the things that they think are important and try to help them to engage in a civil way, because he knows that that's the only way that we can really affect change. But the man is in effect, he just cannot be stopped. He's tireless and has so much energy, and it's been empowering to watch that as well, and to see other leaders within the community respond to that and try to take his lead and counsel. So I think that we're all in a place now where because of the pandemic, our attention has been focused solely on that, and we're now in a point where we can't turn our attention away from what's happening. Right. Either we're watching COVID or we're watching this. And many of us are at home, and this is in our face. And I think it's important to say that, you know, not in a couple of days or a couple of weeks are we going to fix or even change something that has been around for several centuries. But we can start working on it.
Yeah, Joseph Jones of the Harkin Institute. We do go back many years when we think about this in terms of the high-profile deaths. We go back to 2014, Michael Brown, Laquan McDonald, Eric Garner. That's just 2014. Then we had Jamar Clark, Philando Castile, notable cases here in the Midwest, in the Twin Cities in 2015. Now George Floyd in 2020. Of course, a myriad of names I'm not mentioning there that fall into this category. Rachel, should this outbreak of civil protest right now against police brutality have come as a surprise?
I don't think it should have come as a surprise. I'm surprised it hasn't happened earlier. As Joseph notes, this is the result of centuries of oppression, decades in our modern era of systematic discrimination and unequal treatment in law and in fact. And those experiences, you know, social, scientific, and psychological research continues to demonstrate that those experiences take a toll. And as they do, populations come together and realize that this is not acceptable. And so it is in many ways a long-standing, simmering simmering movement that is coming to the surface as a result of a very dramatic and horrific act of violence. I think one of the really interesting things about today's environment is the degree to which these movements can coalesce through social media and can coordinate in a way that they haven't been able to in the past. Mm-hmm. And so whereas we have over the past several decades, we have seen isolated, civil unrest and social protest, the idea that across the country and around the world, you can have this instantaneous communication and this ability to come together and join a common cause, I think is really remarkable. And that poses challenges as well as strengths for this particular moment in our political conversation. But I think as a social dynamic, it is absolutely undeniable that this is something that has been brewing for a long time. And it is a responsibility, I think, of every citizen to take it seriously and to evaluate how we want to respond responsibly and proactively for the future.
Let's talk about the president's words. Our hour is slipping quickly away. Let's talk about the president's words and actions over the past few days. On Monday, the president declared himself the president of law and order. He spoke briefly from the Rose Garden, the White House. Meanwhile, on just the opposite side of Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, law enforcement was deploying means, including rubber bullets, gas, tear gas, I think smoke. It's disputed what that was, to clear the protesters. Let's listen to the president on Monday.
Today, I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets. Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled. If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
Okay, the president went on to describe the previous night's protests in D.C. as a disgrace. He said he was dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, law enforcement officers, and that he was putting, in his words, everybody on warning. Now, we've had developments here just while we've been speaking in here. Defense officials telling AP that the active duty troops brought to the D.C. area in response to the protests are returning to home base. We've had other news there. The Pentagon chief says there's no need for troops to quell protests. A contradiction there of the president's words in the past few days. Joseph, talk a little bit about the president's reactions, because when we heard the president on the weekend, he was at that launching of the SpaceX craft. He had words that reflected, he acknowledged the pain felt by millions of Americans. He called for healing, not hatred, on the weekend. And then we have this sort of whipsaw reaction in the last few days, a law and order message. What are you hearing there? What do you think?
Well, you know, when you think about this, this is something that I believe the states can handle. I spent my time working for Senator Harkin in the Senate, working on national security issues. So my work was with the National Guards across the country, particularly ours in Iowa, but at the Pentagon with the folks at DOD. And I strongly believe that law enforcement agencies and National Guards are more than capable of handling the things that are going on in their individual states. And if the governors need help from the federal government, they'll request it when they need it. What I think that we are hearing is that we want a projection of calm and hope and of resiliency of the American people, and people are not necessarily hearing that from lots of elected officials. But this, again, to our earlier conversations, why elections are important, because we're choosing leaders to engage in conversations on our behalf and make public policy decisions that directly affect our lives. And I did see the notice that the Secretary of Defense said that those Army personnel would not be deployed inside D.C., and I thought that that was a great move.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have critics from the president's own party. Ben Sasse, the senator from our neighbor Nebraska, slamming the president not only for clearing that park, but also holding up a Bible when he arrived at the Episcopal Church near the White House. In Senator Sasse's words in a tweet, there is no right to riot, no right to destroy others' property, no right to throw rocks at police. But there is a fundamental, a constitutional right to protest, and I'm against clearing out a peaceful protest for a photo op that treats the word of God as a political prop. Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska. Rachel, weigh in here on what you're hearing from leaders, especially the Republican congressional leaders, in reaction to what the president has done.
Well, I think across the country, you are seeing a divide among any number of people. Let's be clear that President Trump enjoys provocation. This is kind of his stock and trade, and this is a moment where he can provoke in an effort to reach out to the constituencies that he thinks are particularly critical to his political success. You know, so you can kind of go back, and a lot of parallels have been raised between this particular moment and the 1968 presidential campaign, where Nixon really embraced the idea of law and order. And so, you know, a lot of people have said this is Donald Trump trying to invoke 1968 as a political tool. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a famous Nixon ad where he said very clearly, like, the first right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. And I am the person who will do that. And you hear echoes of that same language now in President Trump's rhetoric. I think he's particularly aiming this rhetoric at suburban white women. But I think he also, you know, the use of the Bible, the emphasis on this particular photo op, I think is also meant to shore up a base of conservative Christian voters that he sees as essential to his success in moving forward into the general election.
Mm-hmm. Right. Many Trump supporters viewed that walk across Lafayette Square as a strength, a demonstration of the president's resolve to end the violence ripping through American cities, something that all Americans, almost all Americans, I guess I should correct myself, that small minority, want to have happen. We don't want our cities destroyed. Joseph, weigh in here. Shouldn't a president show strength and resolve in a time of national crisis? Wasn't that the point of what the president was doing?
Well, I think that he and his advisors may have thought that, but I'm not necessarily sure that that was the message that was received out here in the rest of the country. A president should do that. A president stands above the politics in times like these, and they try to bring people together. They try their best to empathize with the hurt that is happening out there and really show strength in making a difference and bringing people back together, not necessarily dividing them or pushing them further away or continuing to ostracize and alienate them. So I think that that was the expectation that we wanted, but we've seen back and forth that sometimes the issues aren't clearly focused on and followed through.
Okay. In the final 5 minutes of the program, I wanted to have both of you react to some polling that I know both of you have seen. According to a Reuters Ipsos poll released yesterday, a majority of Americans do sympathize with the nationwide protests over the death of George Floyd and also disapprove of the president's response to the unrest. A few details there. The survey conducted Monday and Tuesday of this week found 64% of American adults sympathetic to the people who are out protesting right now. 27% say they were not sympathetic, 9% unsure. And then to pivot over to the view of the president, more than 55% of Americans said they disapprove of Trump's handling of the protests, including 40% strongly disapproving. Just one third say they approved his overall job rating in this poll, 39%. Rachel, I know you've had a look at that polling. We don't have long, but react to what you're seeing there.
Well, I think if you break it down into key constituencies, which is of course anytime we try to conduct polls that connect social happenings to political fortunes, and kind of look at the president's approval rating around these issues. One of the really interesting things to me is the fact that even among rural populations, about just around a majority are sympathetic to the protesters. And as I indicated before, I think the key battleground constituency for the 2020 general election is going to be suburbanites. And among suburbanites, 70% say that they are sympathetic to the protests and the protesters. And I think that that is a particularly important finding of the poll, particularly insofar as Joe Biden, his strength, particularly compared to Hillary Clinton, is his ability to appeal to older suburban white voters. Mm. And so if that is the battleground constituency, then I think this poll tells us something really interesting about what is likely, how this conversation is likely to play out in our political sphere.
Joseph Jones, what do you see in those poll numbers?
You know, I agree with Rachel on many of the aspects that she just mentioned. And I think it also reflects the country's desire to have leaders who are empathetic and can bring people together. And they, being the folks polled and people in general out in the country, they see that this is a problem and people are recognizing this is a systemic issue to work on. And they really want our leaders to focus on that and listen to understand. I think a lot of people are restless and they're looking for leaders to show them how to act in this situation, and because they're not seeing that, they're a little disheartened and are looking for something different. They want to know how they can help and how they can properly respond and react to this, and that's they're looking for a leader to model the way.
Mm-hmm.
I could just kind of, I think Joseph's right. I think one of the challenges that we're facing right now is that policing has always been a local a local function. And so as we look around the country, I mean, 350 different cities have seen protests over the past week. And if policing is essentially a state and local function, it is in some ways difficult to wrap our heads around the great diversity of practices and policies that come into play into this conversation. And I think it is also difficult to identify a clear national response that would be effective across thousands of different localities around the country. And so that national level response, you know, we kind of have some tension going on here in the sense right. that we're dealing with an intensely localized policy issue, but we're looking for national leadership. It's unclear exactly how those two things come together in a productive way.
Rachel Caulfield, we have to go. Professor of Political Science at Drake University, Joseph Jones, Executive Director of the nonpartisan Harkin Institute for Public Policy. We appreciate you being on our program today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
River to River.
Have a great day.
Sure, you too. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.